Hey, music lovers. The Can a Mom Show podcast, in collaboration with Lambkin Guitars, is giving away a custom-built, one-of-a-kind electric guitar built by Josh Lambkin. The solid one-piece hemp wood body includes a built-in glass bowl piece. Yeah, you heard me right. You can take a hit and then play a lick. Now's your chance to help the Can a Mom Show crush cannabis stigma with your entry. Register for the hemp guitar giveaway online at lambkinguitars.com. That's L-A-M-K-I-N guitars.com. The drawing will be part of a 420 celebration at the Goods Dispensary in Somerville, Massachusetts, where the guitar is on display for the month of April. But don't worry, you don't have to live in Mass or be present to win. Visit lambkinguitars.com to scope out the hemp guitar giveaway details and entry form. You'll even find a video of what could be your guitar in action. L-A-M-K-I-N guitars.com. If you're a cannabis business owner looking to expand into new markets and need guidance and support you can trust, consider Collateral Base, a group that has done it before in multiple merit-based and limited market states. Collateral Base was founded by an experienced cannabis attorney with highly educated consultants with master's degrees and years of experience in the cannabis industry. The Collateral Base team is confident they know cannabis licensing better than any of their peers. And I encourage you to see for yourself. It just takes one phone call. If you're ready to expand your cannabis business into new limited markets, contact Collateral Base today at 309-306-1095. That's 309-306-1095. Or visit collateralbase.com.
Everything is personal right here. Everything is personal right here. Everything is personal right here. Len and John rolling it up, listening as they change the industry.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to another episode of Everything is Personal. And today we have a very special guest with us, Mr. Guillermo Rodriguez. Thank you for joining the show.
Good to be here, Len. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I'm not going to go into your bio and all that stuff. I think we'll just go through an introduction by storytelling. So I'm a big fan of really learning about the individual and then like kind of what drove them to do what they do today and, you know, their connection to their passion and all these other things. So before we kind of get into that, let's start with like, where did you grow up?
Well, I was actually born in Mexico. I was born in Piedras Negras, Coahuila, just south of the border. When we were very young, we moved to West. I was about 4 years old when we moved to West Texas. Mm-hmm. And so then I grew up in San Angelo, Texas, very different culture from where I grew up. South Texas was predominantly Spanish speaking. And then I grew up in a different culture in West Texas. I loved it, loved growing up here, and eventually went to college, moved away 20 years, and I just recently moved back about a month ago.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about your family. Do you have your parents are together or not? Do you have siblings?
Yeah, so my stepdad raised me, and my parents were married when I was about 5 years old. So to me, my stepdad was my father. He was the example of, you know, what it meant to be a man. He raised me. And then, like I said, we grew up over here in West Texas. And so I think what was different about my childhood and what kind of what drove me to go into my profession was, you know, as a kid and as a teenager, I was never really handed money. You know, we had everything we needed, but if I needed extra expenses or, you know, needed money to go out, I had to work and get that on my own. And so I still remember on the day that I turned 16, I had a job interview at a pizza parlor. And I knew from a very young age that I needed money for freedom, you know? And so that's really kind of what ties back to what we do, what I do today as a virtual CFO. What drove me to be an accountant is that I knew from that time in my life that financial literacy was empowering, and this knowledge could be helpful to people to help you live the life that you want. And for me, as a teenager, it meant having gas in my car to be able to go places. That meant freedom, or have money to go out and do what I wanted. And so that eventually led to a career in accounting and helping business owners understand their finances. And so that was very much a theme in my childhood. Is I had a credit card as a teenager that I paid off monthly. So I those things about interest rates, how money works, how money grows, all those things, investing and building these habits consistently and getting those muscles in place is something that I learned very early on from a personal standpoint. And now, you know, applying that to the business side of things.
So when you were a kid, were you like, I understand working. I worked since I was, 13 years old, and I understood the value of money. My parents, I'm an immigrant too. My parents would work and I would come home like latchkey kid and be by myself, and I had to come home when the lights went on kind of thing. So I did the same thing. I worked, I delivered newspaper. I worked in a pizza place and all that. But it didn't really, like, I knew the value of money. I knew that I need to fend for myself, but it didn't really connect me to this whole thing of, okay, now that I need to do this for myself, I need to figure out ways to, you know, get my own bank account and credit card. It didn't really connect me to a purpose of, now I need to take this information and serve others. It wasn't really a connection for me. How did it become this connection for you as a teenager?
I think it started with, I knew that I needed that money to move out of my parents' house. You know, what was different about me is that I went to college in the town that I grew up, and I was here mainly because it was the best option from a financial standpoint. And for many years, I was like, oh, I wanted the college experience to go out. But, you know, now looking back, I had a great college experience. There's fun things to do in this town. Now that I'm here, I can see how much of a great college experience it was for me. But at that time, I really wanted to move out of this small town that I grew up in. And I knew, so first it came from a selfish standpoint. I knew that I needed to choose a career that I could make money. And accounting and nursing at my college were the two careers that had a 100% placement rate. And so I knew without a doubt that I could get a job. And sure enough, about a month before graduating, I had one job offer at a public accounting firm here in town, and then I had a job offer with the Department of Agriculture, agricultural marketing services. So I started my career in the federal government, learning how commodities are traded and priced, and as an auditor, and that was really my first job, professional job, and getting my feet wet and making some money and getting out on my own. And so I had a long career in corporate. And what really drove me in the beginning was I wanted to learn, and I wanted to be more of a holistic business person, even though I was an accountant, got my CPA right within that first year. And so if I look back at my career, I made that change. And then I was more of a historical accountant, like all of us. And what's happening now with accounting is it's moving more into advisory, right? Clients are wanting more advice on how to grow their business, how to reach their goals. But I was having fun in corporate. I was really learning a lot. I love the camaraderie, all the people. I love what we did. And so I was a historical accountant looking back. I was running the numbers, putting the financial statements together, issuing them on time, getting past that audit from EY, all that kind of stuff. But when things really changed for me is I like those new opportunities. We came to a point, this was a large company, a construction engineering contractor that I worked for 15 years or so. And we were making an acquisition. And at that point, we needed a skill set to build a financial statement forecasting process to get that deal across, kind of like tradition, what you would think in traditional M&A, what an investment banker would do, but we needed to do this internally. And so that's when I changed my career into more of a forward-looking corporate finance role, and that I was helping the business forecast our financial statements going forward. At this point, it was to see how we would bring in this new business, you know, synergies, growing margins, all these things, and how the new business would look. And so we needed everybody on board to see this, the banks, everyone, to get this deal approved. And then that led on to more cash flow forecasting. For every business, especially in construction, there was variability in cash from month to month. And so we really had to understand how cash moved on a weekly basis. And that's, of course, what we do with our clients now in the small business world. But getting a handle on how your cash moves, your cash conversion cycle. But I got to a point, and I think this is everybody during COVID, where we dug a little bit deeper, and that was me. I think a couple of years before COVID, I was starting to think, like, what am I really passionate about? You know, where do I want to take my life? And I was single at the time, so maybe I had more time to think about these things. And so I wasn't really quite ready yet. So I went through a couple year period of just exploring what am I passionate about? What do I want to do? So I was learning a lot about, or not a lot about, but I was starting to learn about Ayurvedic medicine and more holistic ways to treat your health, to grow. And I was teaching yoga for a bit and that kind of thing. But I think when things really changed for me was during COVID, because through that experience, I saw that we could really empower ourselves from a health standpoint to battle COVID. And what I mean by that is that I could see that we had people dealing with chronic illness were particularly susceptible to the virus. So my idea, and I was really frustrated about this, was that I was going to my employer and saying, like, we have a platform to talk about chronic health. This is something that we can change with exercise, with movement, with plant medicine, a lot of what you do. And we could take a long-term approach to this and really get through this with better health. I know it was more of an emergency, but no one would listen to me. I think the platform there was more of an immediate response, those who had a voice. And I think things really changed for me when my employer was just being very strict on some mandates and things. And I said, you know, my core value is really freedom, you know, and if I wasn't able to move around and do the things that I needed to do, I felt like it was time to move on. And so at that point, I left corporate with all that I'd learned. You know, I've been in corporate finance, I've been in accounting. Part of that includes risk management, treasury operations, all these things. And I said, I want to go into consulting, and I want to help business owners who are similar in that they want the freedom to choose, you know, their own path to well-being, whether it be from their clients or their employees or customers, and help owners. And I saw, you know, cannabis as, you know, one of the main industries that was doing that in so many different ways, right? Whether it's from the expungements and some of the good things that have come out of it, to really helping people through a more holistic approach and helping people with stress and sleep, and some of these symptoms that can help you move on to more you choosing your own path to well-being. And the opposite of that is a prescriptive, same approach. Everybody gets this treatment, is what I saw during COVID. And so I just really wanted to make a change. If I could go on a little bit longer, sure, I would say in cannabis, very few businesses are profitable. You know, they're with the tax, with the heavy competition and the tax, the IRS, you know, taking most of your pre-tax dollars, very few businesses are profitable. And so what we really need in the industry are better business practices and more empowered decisions through understanding data and not suffering unnecessarily, so that these business owners, kind of going back to why I started with this, so we can achieve what we set out to do in the first place in the cannabis industry, whatever that may be for you, right? And so we need profitable and sustainable businesses to be able to accomplish that, whether that may be some business owners are first-time business owners and can create legacy for family, or just simply getting this, helping more people through this plant. Whatever the case may be, we need better business practices and a higher level of sophistication, especially in the small business world. And so that's what I'm all about as a virtual CFO and an advisor in the space.
It's really important, a lot of things that you said. First of all, I grew up my first job out of school was Price Waterhouse, PwC, later during an acquisition. So you're unique in the sense that I didn't really particularly care for the cutthroat environment of, working in at that time, the big six firm where you're working, 12-hour days and everybody's trying to backstab you so they can position themselves for partner. But I would say that was a tremendous education because it was just like so much stuff that was coming at you and you had to be able to prepare for different things. And the other thing that you mentioned was this whole thing of accounting. And I was going to actually ask you about the difference between, you have a CPA, why do you need a CFO? But I think you actually really gave me the Cliff's Notes version of this. The way I kind of looked at it, and I think you just confirmed it, is the CPAs really look at your past and do the accounting on, just do your accounting, do your numbers. But where you have the advisory role of a CFO is you're actually looking at your future and you're forecasting your future. You do look at your past as well, but you're actually positioning yourself for what the future is and then checking to see if what you predicted is actually working and then making those adjustments. And I think it's such an important thing. And, my experience is right now currently within sort of the quasi-cannabis industry. We have a genetics company, but it is connected to cannabis and other things. But even in previous businesses, you have this notion of, as a CEO, where I sit, raising money is an important thing, like as part of my job description. Every single time I had a mentor, every single time I go raise a round, I'm like, okay, we're cool. It goes, no, that's one of the things you're going to be doing forever. That's your job. And I never really understood that. But, in this is my third or fourth company that we actually got funding for, and the importance of a role of a CFO when you get funded. And I think this is one of the things that I've seen in the cannabis industry happen over and over and over, where especially when you look at the, where the hot time within the cannabis market was, maybe it was about, 2018, 2019, a lot of companies were getting funded. And you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars flowing into these companies. And then what you see is the operational inefficiency. So one of the things that will happen is, what do you want to do? And we'll talk about different exits of how do you position yourself for IPO? What's a good exit? And is a Reg A an option? These kind of things. But I'm just curious for myself. And so you have this flow of capital that's coming in, and then the investment goes into, what we're going to do is we're going to scale cultivation. So we got all this money. Now we're going to scale cultivation. Without the foresight of knowing you're making all this product, you're creating and processing this product into oil. Well, where are you going to sell it? Is there even a market? I was looking at all these publicly traded companies in Canada because that was the thing to do. You go in Canada, it's legal. You can go on the public market. And now you're getting all this money and you're investing. But what are you investing in? Is there a brand? What is the strategy? And that was always interesting to me. And we're part of guilty as well, because we committed a lot of our resources to direct-to-consumer opportunities, where if I would have really forecasted out and worked with the CFO, we had a CFO, but we moved off for a while because of the cost of having a CFO on your payroll and having a virtual CFO, I think, and a fractional CFO, I think makes a lot more sense in this industry. But looking at the ability to be able to know upfront and know sort of the pitfalls helps you do so much better with the planning, because I would have seen and said, okay, the profitability of, you know, working on trying to acquire 1,000 customers is really less than working and getting 5 business-to-business customers that will actually allow me to 10x my profitability instead of, you know, the amount of work that it takes to get 1,000 customers. So I really want people to understand that it's not just an accounting function. Because that's the pushback that I've heard so many times. Oh, why do I need that? I have my CPA. They're good with the numbers. This strategy that is a missing gap in a lot of these businesses. And besides 280E, which we can talk about too, the position of a company to be able to, first of all, take advantage of the what they have today, plan for the future, position themselves for what is that next exit. And by the way, it could be an acquisition, it could be a merger, or it could be next funding round, or it can be none of those things. So I want you to kind of talk about, you know, your area of expertise in some of these things that I mentioned and how to leverage that, because that's the pushback I've heard so many times sitting in boardrooms of, you know, what is my CFO actually doing? And I think that's really the value that I really want people to understand.
Yeah, one of the things, those are all great points. One of the things you mentioned is being in the industry. Doesn't my CPA do that?
Yeah.
The typical CPA that's doing the regulatory work for you is not going to be able to help you understand your market, you know, and it's surprising how many folks go into business not knowing what is the total addressable market. And within cannabis, it's so different in every state and different within your local, you know, jurisdiction. And so it starts with that, is really helping our clients understand what is the market, doing the deep research to understand, and then going a little bit more into it and understanding your own particular customer segments to optimize your product offering. And so another thing that you mentioned is in the forward looking piece of it is that you are making all these investments, you're making all these changes. So you get to understand all that, but you really want to know the basis for how we help our clients do this is we call it dynamic forecasting. And the reason we call it dynamic is because right now it's January 10th. We just went through helping our clients set what we call the plan. And so we come up with a financial statement forecast for the rest of the year that's set in stone, that we always going to look back and see where did we start the year thinking we would be. And then taking all these things like the market, the metrics, what you can accomplish, not just a 10% growth, but saying more specifically, we help the clients understand what are the metrics and the things that they have to measure. And then saying, okay, if I can increase my, as an example, the size of my transactions by $5, where will I be? And then the next step is, from an actionable standpoint, saying what are the behaviors that you need to have to be able to increase that by that $5, you know, whether that may be training your staff, monitoring how your butt tenders are performing, that kind of thing. We want to really get to a place of what are the actionable steps. And even within a cannabis business, you know, I think we say like we have an 80%, like our approach, you know, 80% of it, we can take it client to client regardless of industry. And then that 20%, even within the industry, we have to tailor it to really get to know the operations, the unique business, to understand what it is that we need to measure and then what actions we need to take to improve profitability. And then we could either look back and say, was this the market? Was this, that's the historical piece. Was this the market? Is this something you didn't do? And that's what we do as a consultant. The, I wouldn't say the hard part of our job, but the necessary part of our job is to be truthful with client and be accountable to what we said. And so that I think that is one of the big differences to what you speak of,
yeah,
is that we step in as a consultant, and as consultants, we're truth tellers. We can't shy away. And as an outside person, that's much easier. It's a much better relationship to come in from the outside, looking in. You know, we're not within the organization. These are clients. So we're able to really stay objective, and help the client see if they're wanting that growth. You know,
yeah, I mean, it's a must for business to be able to do that and to be truthful. Sometimes you're too close to it. So maybe I can use this example. So every year, outside of my business, I sit down and I write my goals. And my goals are, and I write my goals for different categories. Like, so I have my health goals, and I have my my relationship goals, and I have my, you know, my career goals, and my financial goals, my spiritual goals. I have all that stuff. And what I do, the first thing I do in the beginning of the year, or right before the, because I just went through this exercise, is I check to see what I have achieved from the previous year, and see if there is a value, or if it still makes sense, if I'm connecting to this goal to ones I did not achieve, to put them onto my next year's goals. So doing this for a business, I think, is invaluable, because really understanding, and probably not once a year, you should do this on a quarterly basis, most likely, but it really helps to take the temperature of a business. And you know, Ray Dalio, I was listening to Ray Dalio speak not too long ago, and he was talking about, he wrote this book about, you know, I don't remember the name of the book, so somebody can Google it, but it talks about the, I guess, taking the temperature of a business is similar to what a country is doing, when a country may be in trouble. And he talks about these things about, you know, having too much debt, having division, having lack of focus, all these different things. So I guess it's a long-winded way of asking a question about a KPI question, but more than a KPI question, it's what are some of the important factors that you would have to see as a CPA, as a CEO, because I don't want to read a lot of things. What are some of the important things that I need to check on to check the temperature of my business to make sure that it's still optimized for success? And where are some of those things that I need to be aware of, or anybody that's you know, in business, be aware of, that these are problematic, and address them early on so they don't start festering? So what are some of those areas that we should be looking at?
Sure. And some of those things, whether your goal is just straight up profitability, or whether, you know, there's owners that it's not so much focus on profitability, but they just love to employ a lot of people and grow a larger business, you know? And so it starts with what you said, is understanding that why, and then making sure the behaviors are all headed in that direction. But our consulting approach has always been, and I've found this to be true, whether I was working in large business or public companies, or now, you know, small business owners from, you know, 2 to 20 million or so, but that there's really three areas of metrics that we cover. And those would be the production metrics, what we call the pipeline or the customer metrics, and then the financial metrics. And the financial is probably the ones that you're most familiar with, and that are a little bit more historical based, but you still want to understand where's your gross margin for your industry, for your particular vertical, how much overhead you should be carrying for your business. So as an example, you may be a little bit heavy on your overhead. Let's say you're a cannabis retailer, right? And a cannabis retailer that wants to expand. And so, okay, we'll build a plan to scale and know that during this period, you're going to be carrying a little bit more overhead, or rent, because your sales aren't up yet until you get ramped up. And so we can look at those things and see, okay, maybe you're carrying a little bit more, but this is why, or this is where your sales need to be by this point, so you don't eat this much cash. And so that's what we call the financial metrics, and it really helps to benchmark against industry. So you can say, okay, I am where I'm at. So like a retailer would, a successful cannabis retailer would need to be somewhere around a 20% net income margin, right? Total over tax. And so if we're at 5% or 10%, we're going to look at that and see, okay, how do we get to that 20%? Same with gross margin. And so those are the financial metrics. Obviously, you know, you're in trouble if you're at a loss, but what this helps more is set those goals of like, how do I control my overhead costs? How do I become more efficient? And then the ideas just start flowing on where are some of those ways you can start to cut costs. The second part would be production. And so that has everything to do with the production of your business. And in retail, we track things like the average order, the number of transactions. And if you see any of those things changing, again, looking at your markets, it's different in all of them, we'll start to look at why, you know, and that's where you get into what marketing channels aren't working, what customers you're not recapturing. And the third and most important piece of it, not most important, but they all work together, is the customer metrics. Because in order to fuel the business, you got to really understand the customer metrics. If customers are leaving, you got to understand why, but more importantly, how to get them back, right? And what is really nice about this piece as a forecasting tool is that when you have metrics like customer retention or recurring revenue, it only helps your forecast become more reliable. You're more likely to hit the numbers that you set out to be, whether there's less uncertainty in the business, right? But you don't know that until you really learn how to measure those things, where to get the data. And the big piece of this is reviewing it regularly, you know? So we found there's a lot of great tools for cannabis companies out there with data analytics now with AI. It's just not being used, and it's not being used on a regular basis. And so those are really the three areas I would say, is just to start looking at those three. Just to recap, you know, looking at my financials, where am I in comparison to the industry? Where am I in comparison to maybe my own particular market? My production around sales, and then my customer metrics. And those three areas really work together to give you an idea of the health of a business, but more importantly, how to make decisions to move it forward, you know?
Yeah. No, I think that those are really, really important keys to be aware. If a company is looking to scale and, you know, like, once again, I'll use me as an example. If my goal is to reward my shareholders, like I need to make sure that my shareholders are happy. There's some sort of exit somewhere. There's something, even though maybe we're paying dividends or maybe, but they want to see that there's some sort of financial windfall for a return on their investment, and perhaps they can reinvest with me again in the future. So one of the things I always look at is a way to be able to scale and have an exit in mind. And by the way, that exit can be that scale. You know, we're now a US, we're a global company, but now we decided to, you know, move into different countries. So that's scale, and that's working towards our exit. However, you know, in the cannabis space especially, there is a lot of consolidation. There's a lot of mergers and acquisitions. There's a lot of, because there's very few profitable companies, so that they think if they join forces, there is an opportunity. And I'm not sure I'm seeing that or not. Maybe it's unique to the cannabis market. However, there's also a unique thing in the cannabis market that I've seen is IP. So there's companies that have IP and they invest in IP. And you were talking about, you know, some of the goals of the company. Well, maybe a company is not that profitable. However, it has a lot of IP. And in this valuation and forecasting, yes, you mentioned a lot of really important factors to gauge your temperature of working your business on a daily basis and a quarterly basis. But how do you take this unique animal as the cannabis business, and sort of put a valuation on that for those different exit strategies, whether it be an M&A, whether it be an IPO, whether it be something like a Reg A, because you have these unique factors. Like, there's one way to value your equipment. There's one way to value, you know, okay, we have X amount of customers, revenue. But there's these intangible things like IP, like unique ways that you're extracting something, or there's, because I'm not even sure if there's a value of a brand in cannabis. I'm not even sure anybody can name five household cannabis brands yet, or three even. So this, because the industry is so young and so complicated, so disjointed, you have states that are creating policy that are specific to that state that don't carry over to other states for a product that is still Schedule One. It's such a unique animal and so strange. So I just wanted to understand this unique nuance and how you position companies and how you take those companies to their next level, looking at some of these things, not just your traditional accounting methods and your traditional KPIs, just adding some of those nuances as well.
Yeah, so you mentioned earlier that 2018 to 2020 was a good, those were the good years for cannabis, right? And naturally, as markets get up and going, there's a lot of excitement from the consumer base. There's less supply than demand. So the dynamics have been great for good, strong sales. And I think there has been that outlook that we would have a reschedule much sooner than what we're anticipating now. And so a lot of that capital, that perceived value, has dried up. I'll touch on one thing you said is the IP assets. First of all, there's always ways to just make sure you're protecting your assets. Even without spending money on an attorney, there's some very basic tips on how to do that. So I would encourage anyone to make sure you're doing your research to protect your IP assets. But I think the writing on the wall, it's just clear that there has to be a sustainable plan for the business and to grow cash through profitability and through operations. And so that's why I say it comes back to making these day-to-day decisions on how you're going to grow gross margin and how you're going to retain customers. And that leads into the story of, you know, what we talked about earlier, is whether it's investors or your existing shareholders, is being able to tell the story of how the business is getting to profitability and continue to grow profitability. But it's not just a story. It's based on these metrics that we've seen trending up as we've been growing the business. And so to me, that's how we position the business for growth and an exit, is through developing the right metrics and growing through all these different things, whether it's product assortment, different inventory responding to changes in markets, addressing a particular market segment that we weren't targeting. You know, just as an example, the pre-roll category is growing. Are you in a segment where you have Generation Y or Z, I can't remember which is the one that prefers the pre-rolls, but understanding all...
Yeah, they don't know how to roll a joint. That's the issue.
Yeah. And so, you know, all those things can be demonstrated through numbers, and that's the part of storytelling that will help the business grow, whether through additional funding or... explaining where you're going through to your existing shareholders. And so I say all that to say that, you know, some of the things that you talk about in terms of valuing the intangibles part of the business is that there was a lot of overvaluation right through those COVID years, perhaps. And in some cases, if you're just looking at a retail business that maybe you're looking that was going to grow based on, you know, regulatory change, it just didn't happen. And so that's why I think the way we look at it, the way I look at it, is we got to be able to grow in the current environment. And it's just much the reality is it's just much tougher in cannabis, right? It's just a hard way to make a living. We know that, but we're passionate about it, and we do see some change, and we're getting there.
Yeah, it's interesting because you know, that we had this green rush. I had back in the day, like 2009, 2010, I was in the dispensary business, and it was like that was the word that was used, the green rush. You're making money. But with regulation changes, all that went away. And when big business came in and said, all right, there's we're going to invest in, you know, 300 dispensaries, or we're going to go public, it just doesn't, it didn't work right. And the reason why I keep bringing up this, you know, IP and other intangibles, because in other industries, there's comparables, right? So there is historical comparables. Like, you can say, okay, for a company like this, yes, there are a valuation because you're generating revenue, and there's you can talk about numbers, but there's intangibles. And by the way, there is probably about, you know, 100 companies like you that I can compare this to, that I can start valuing, doing a valuation for the business and looking at those. We don't have a lot of those in the cannabis space. So to be, I'm just trying to position the value of a CFO, how important it is to be able to take, yes, your your forecast with your numbers, that maybe you're, you know, looking at your CPA that helped put those numbers together, but actually looking at the intangibles of your business, putting a valuation on them as well, doing the due diligence, looking at the TAM, looking at all those things, and positioning the company correctly, because that way there's a level of transparency and trust. Because if I'm doing this on my own, it's going to be questioned. But if it's done with the support of a CFO, that also will be questioned, but will be questioned less because there is a lot of data to support that. So I'm just trying to let the my colleagues in the industry, and even outside of this industry, know and understand that when you're working with a CFO who's looking at positioning your business for the next step in your business, scale, acquisition, M&A, everybody's looking to see what that exit will be. Well, maybe you're not positioned correctly for an IPO. Maybe this isn't where, there's a lot of companies that did reverse shell mergers, went public on, you know, Canadian exchanges. Why? What did they have to show for it? And one of the issues with the entire industry is because of that. Low-hanging fruit and immediate, you know, let's cash out really quick, and it doesn't really work that way. You have to create a sustainable business that does that. However, some companies are not positioned for the future for that profitability. Their focus is, you know, let's say science, right? So they're creating a lot of science, still adding a tremendous value to the industry, still creating IP, but in order for them to go to the next step, they have to combine forces with somebody who's taken their science and taken it fruition to market. So understanding those nuances, I think, are really important, and there's a uniqueness to the cannabis industry. So I guess I wanted to understand from your experience, having worked in, you know, the traditional corporate landscape and all that stuff, what makes cannabis so unique that you need that level of expertise, not just any financial expert, somebody that really understands that specific industry? Why is cannabis so unique?
One of the main reasons is because getting to profitability is so difficult after tax and building cash, right? And then there's less capital. So how are you going to grow a sustainable business unless you're really optimizing sales and watching your cash and seeing how you're going to keep the business moving forward day to day? And what we're trying to avoid is some of the things that you're talking about, is selling the business early without for less than what you thought, or a lot of what's going on right now, which is what we call the distressed assets, and a lot of purchase of distressed assets. And so we're trying to avoid all that. And that's how we do that, is through profitability and positioning the company for growth.
Mm. So 280E, the reason why, and you can explain it better than I can, but you can't, write off normal course of business items like you would any other. It's when I tell people this that are not familiar with the industry, it's mind boggling to them. What do you mean? I have a storefront, you know, I have expenses. What do you mean I can't write those off? You can't write those off. So what are the strategies that are unique to the cannabis industry? And I understand profitability, but what are some of those strategies that are unique to the industry because they have some of these regulatory obstacles to overcome?
Yeah, so you mentioned the non-deductibility, and I think that's a big topic right now, right? We've dealt with 280E for many years, and for those who are not as familiar with it, there's a non-deductibility of basically overhead expenses. And so a typical cannabis company can pay anywhere from 70 to 100% effective tax rate. Doesn't leave much room for cash after tax. And so that's very unique to the cannabis industry. But I've heard of a few recent things. You know, historically, what we've done is there's a cost accounting method under 471, where essentially cannabis companies can take some of the direct costs and move them into cost of goods sold, because that cost of goods sold can offset your taxable income. But even after that, just what's allowed, you still end up with a high of tax rate. And so if the reschedule happens, 280E goes away and cannabis companies pay taxes at the federal level, just like any other company. I've seen a few recent articles. I don't know if you've read them, Len, but where, like, you've seen Trulieve that is challenging 280E right now. I haven't seen disclosed too much of what their position is on that, but there's also other companies that are taking a position where the tax code disallows the deductibility of cost of goods sold in the current year, and so they're deducting them in the subsequent year. And so there's a lot of these things that are going on. I haven't seen them go all the way to a court case where it would, you know, I guess where it's more of an industry-wide practice, but there's also been cannabis companies that are just not paying the taxes and waiting for 280E, and there's just kind of taking that risk. So there's a whole bunch of different things going on. I've heard the number from Whitney Economics that if the 280E goes away, the extra cash into the industry is somewhere right around $2 billion. And so that's a pretty big number. But, you know, back to your question, that is what is unique about cannabis, is that you're dealing with not only these really high taxes at the federal level, but in order to sell your product, you're also dealing with higher product costs at the consumer level because of the high excise taxes and different things. What's unique about it is, you know, hopefully we get to a point where it's treated more like alcohol and there could be a very similar tax, kind of countrywide, an excise tax. But that is what unique about cannabis, is that we haven't really developed one product that's recognizable all across the country in one market like you would have with a cigarette, right? It's familiar everywhere. And so there's different excise taxes in different municipalities, and some of them are so high or double stacked that to the end consumer, it makes it very expensive compared to, say, the illicit market. So that's another thing that's unique and that cannabis is dealing with right now that's trying to be addressed, but I think it'll take a long time just because of the structure of how every state is a different market. And so that's something that we'll continue to have to deal with in the coming years, is that's what we call that, you know, the price compression at the retail level. But some of that is also happening just because things are normalizing. You know, cannabis is new, consumers are finally kind of starting to settle down. And so now you're starting to see like more normal behaviors in more established markets. And, you know, states that issue too many licenses and contributed to that problem. But that is really what's unique about cannabis, is that you have all those different prices in different states for the same products. And so there's not a kind of a consistent pricing strategy across the country like what you would see in a normal CPG industry. So that makes it very difficult, but also to compound the problem, you have operators that are not using the data to price appropriately and to discount appropriately. So that's another big problem in the industry, is that there's a big level of over discounting to maintain profit share. It's eating up profitability, but it's also hurting the market because it's kind of undercutting other operators. And so the ones that will remain profitable and be sustainable have to find ways to price their product for more of a long-term strategy, right? But then you also have to be able to manage cash through that. And so that's where all these kind of variables come into play, and where your forecasting can really help you understand that, yes, you may be taking a more of a long-term approach, but you're also going to be okay from a cash standpoint or not, you know? And
yeah, no, it makes total sense. And I definitely think that, you know, when you look at surveys, what people are buying, you know, they're buying discounts, people are price shopping. And hence, makes this industry unique, because it actually emphasizes the illicit market. Because if a company needs to sustain, you know, not only 280, not only their taxes, but you have operational expense, you have all these different things, and you're running a legitimate business, and now you have, you know, your buddy down the street that opens up a shop and sells $20 less, well, there is no loyalty. And we were talking about branding. There's no loyalty. There's no branding. There's no standardization in this industry. And I, you know, you mentioned alcohol and cigarettes, and I think that is not the way that cannabis should be looked at, because it's not equivalent to those. Yes, I understand the standardization and pricing model, but it really is a therapeutic wellness product. And at the end of the day, I think we lost focus in this industry when we started going recreational, because at the end of the day, people that have specific conditions are going into a dispensary looking for their therapeutic product and ending up you know, buying a bag of gummies, or ending up having, you know, 1,000 different dab or concentrate options, and where are my different minor cannabinoids, where are my blends? And that's going away. And the reason why it's going away is because that market is shifting, and the only differentiator, because, you know, a lot of these companies gave up on trying to differentiate their brand. So like, hey, we might as well just make compete on price and THC level. Exactly. So it really takes away. And one of the biggest challenges, you know, like I met with the FDA recently, had a conversation with them. And if you look at what's going on with the FDA now, the FDA actually would like to reschedule. They've published some communication that they're looking to reschedule. Whether they should deschedule or reschedule, that's a separate conversation. But at least there is an understanding that is not a Schedule One. It has medicinal therapeutic purposes, obviously. The DEA said, we make that decision. Well, okay, you make that decision. However, if there's a suggestion that there is therapeutic purposes, it should be looked at as that. And then you have the pharmaceutical industry that says, well, yes, there is, but we're the only ones that can actually produce a therapeutic agent, because it has to go through the right channels of the FDA approval. So we're going around the circle, and there really is no one solution that's winning the whole thing. So in the meantime, you have to be able to recognize that it is what it is for the time being. If things change, that's great. But I think you hit the nail on the head when investors started coming in and saying that I'm going to invest to see, because the future of this industry is going to change. Well, the future of this industry may change, but we have no idea how it's changed, because there's not one single beacon in state. I'll use this one last example. In Georgia, they decided that they're going to distribute cannabis through pharmacies, and they're going to minimize or limit the amount of THC for those products. The DEA actually is trying to stop that right now, because they're saying the pharmacies cannot distribute an illicit substance that's a Schedule One, even though the FDA already made that suggestion to reschedule that. So now they're involved, federal is involved in that state distribution. So a state that is trying to do right. They took a long time to say, okay, we're going to start and we're going to address this illicit market by allowing people to purchase their cannabis, whatever condition you have, if you're taking it for anxiety, you're taking it to help you sleep, taking the edge off, or you have a legitimate medical condition, you have to go into a pharmacy. For that reason, there is standardization. So number one, there is standard of testing. Number two, there is standard of dosing. And now you're going to get somewhere because you have a feedback loop on, is it efficacious? Are you practicing harm reduction? All those different things. But they decide not to do it that way for the time being. So there are models outside of the United States that are doing this in that same way. And there will be a recreational market for them. It's just this level of, as you said, my product in California is not the same as my product in Pennsylvania. And obviously, Texas is a whole different world that we can talk about too. But until we get to the point of, at the very least, let's all decide that we're going to test the product the same way in every single state. We're going to provide the end user customer a label that says the same thing everywhere. We're never going to get out of the dark ages. Even if you have a supplemental fact, just look at a supplemental fact. How many states are not don't have different testing regulations? How many states are not requiring terpene testing, different heavy metal testing? Like if I'm treating this as a, let's say it's a recreational product or just an adult use product, well, at the very least, it's a supplement, right? So I should be able to pick up whatever it is I'm in my vitamin shop, and I should be able to see consistency on those labels. And that's, I think, a huge, huge gap in this industry. And I think that's really, really hurting the future of this industry. And that's why in the investment community is also sort of, well, you know, it's not, nothing has solidified. So I guess the question is, you having a crystal ball, and understanding that we have no control over, you know, regulations. Is there a state I should be investing in? Is there a type of business? Is more retail? Where do you think, if I'm an investor, if I'm sitting as an investor, what should be some of these opportunities that I'm looking at for the future, have that sort of crystal ball?
Well, at the retail level, I would say, for one, is understanding those markets, you know, and seeing which markets are doing things right. You know, I think to some degree, even the really healthy markets like Missouri will start to see some pressure on pricing here over the next year, even though they were off to a good start. And same with Maryland. But I think as an investor, first looking at the fundamentals and the story of where that business is going and how they're going to navigate around competition. So it's going back to what you said is sustainability and the lack of focus. And so we know that from a form factor category, I mean, overall is about 50% of sales are in the flower category. And it's a little bit different from retail for each retailer. And some may do very well in that, but I think if we just simply compete on flower THC content and price, that's going to be a losing strategy, right? So as an investor, you got to look for the operators that are looking outside of that and seeing the real growth is coming from these, the new categories, the kind of curious, the educated consumer or what have you, but it's not going to be in continuing to just pound on the flower category and competing on price. And so those are some of the dynamics that you have to look at. And one of the things that you mentioned earlier, well, how cannabis is different, but how it is the same is that if you're competing on that commodity category, that category is the same as any other industry in that if there's an oversupply, it's going to put pressure, it's going to create a market imbalance and a profit pressure at the end of the day, right? So that's really not the long-term strategy. And so you got to look at the companies that are really working with the consumer, with the customer, that are really educating their bud tenders and then passing on that education onto to the consumers because there's a lot of new customers to capture. And those will be particularly those who are wanting specific help for these specific health problems, and they want consistency in the product. And I'm one of those that is looking for that, right? And so I know just from personal experience of how I could walk in somewhere, and I've walked into a dispensary or a retail store here in Texas, and they're like, hey, this stuff has high THC. I'm like, I'm not that kind of consumer. Yeah. And so you need that bud tender to be educated. And that's one of the things that...
Or you can take an endoDNA test, a shameless plug for my company, and know exactly what you're susceptible to if you have a predisposition to adverse effects from certain things. So there you go.
No, that's exactly, that's another way to look at and to gain more education. And that's great. I mean, these are ancillary services that within cannabis are creating that more educated consumer. The more educated consumers can be more empowered, spend more, that kind of thing. And so I think that's what you should really be looking for as an investor, is that that sustainable pricing strategy, that long-term view of the business, and also a business who understands how things are going to change, and how they're going to put that capital to work. Yeah. Hopefully we see the 280E change will bring in additional capital into the market, and how that capital is going to be put in place to grow the business. I think so. Those are some of the key things you got to look out for.
Cool. I have a few questions left that I ask all my guests. So we'll sort of shift a little bit of focus from numbers to experiences. So first question is, please describe your first experience with cannabis.
I'll describe a more recent experience. And so I'm in Texas, right? I'm in San Antonio. As you know, we don't have a rec program. We have a very limited medical use program. But I went to my juice bar, my favorite juice bar, and I noticed they were selling flower out of a vending machine and for $35. And I said, okay. I talked to the, not the bud tender, but the juice guy, and he recommended a particular strain for me. I thought I was getting something to help energize me, and it turned out that it was more of a relaxing strain. So I went home, and then, mind you, I took this. I went home, rolled it, because I prefer very much to kind of to roll it. To I like that experience, and sat on my porch, and I was like, wow, I can't move. And so I was like, it was interesting, because what I felt like the effect of it was that it just almost like the plant really like knew what I needed. And it said, you got to freeze right now because you really need some rest. Wow. And, it was a good experience. I actually was able to rest and recuperate. And so, it was a really good experience. But what I realized is that if I was resisting it, I was starting to have a really good experience. And so I just learned on how to kind of ease into it and kind of trust in that, really knew what I needed. And so I was able to rest in that. And I also, we have some great products, and speaking of the minor cannabinoids and some of the things that you mentioned, is we have some great, great companies in Texas doing great things. And I use, THCV on occasion for focus and that kind of thing. But, maybe we can talk offline later, but more curious about what you do and really trying to focus in on that test and what I need. Cause I think I'm very much still on that journey, is learning what's specific to me. And that goes back to my original kind of story, in that I think healthcare wellness is really all about tailoring your practices to your individual needs. Yeah. And I love that, because that, I know that's what you do with your testing and your company.
Yeah. And so it's absolutely a personalized experience for everything. It's precision medicine, precision wellness, really. And I think you brought up a really interesting point, where sometimes whatever, this is a controversial thing because I look at cannabis as especially THC is also some sort of psychedelic, even though it's not classified as that. But when you're consuming certain types of psychedelic wellness products or medicine, the need to control actually changes your experience. So once we let go and we listen to where the medicine's trying to guide us, it becomes a better experience. And I think, you know, besides doing your genetic predispositions, because we don't look at things that are going to be perfect for you, great for you first. We're looking to see how you can avoid those potholes in the road. Where do we see genetically that you may consume something but can turn on the switch that creates an adverse effect? Same thing with dosing and all those things. Once you can avoid and navigate, now you have sort of your shelf. Like, these are the things that are more aligned with me, and you can you know, work within those confines to make sure you mitigate or avoid an adverse event. So that's really the key. But it's like listening, connecting to plant medicine all the way around, listening to the plant and giving to you what you need in that moment. I think it's really you know, an interesting approach, and that's the way that the plant needs to be respected, I think. And I think we forgot how to use that properly. Okay, music. I'm a big music guy, so I have some music questions. Do you remember the first concert that you ever attended? And if so, what was it?
I was 12 years old. I remember I was wearing a green shirt. I don't know why I remember that. And it was Joan Jett. Do you remember Joan Jett? And the,
of course, Blackhearts. Yeah,
that was that was my first concert. And I remember I was 12 years old. I was with my parents, and there was a girl that I liked from school, and she was there. And I remember that I saw her there, and I went up to the front of the stage with her and hung out and watched the concert. And that was, like, at the time, I think I was on top of the world at that moment. And I will always remember that concert.
Super cool. What was the last concert you attended? I know you have a little kid, so I'm sure you're not getting out to too many shows now.
The last concert. So as I got older, I really like going to like more shows, smaller venues. In San Antonio, we have the Aztec Theater is one of the first theaters in downtown. They bring bands to their smaller concert venue. The last one I went to was Los Lobos from LA.
Of course.
And I loved it so much. I chose one of their songs for our wedding song, for our first dance.
It wasn't a remake of La Bamba, was it?
It wasn't La Bamba, but I think it was one of the, it was We Belong Together. So
I know, that's a great song too.
That's a special song for me now.
Very cool. All right, so another music question, and I'm putting you on the spot, and so I'm going to ask the question, and I'll continue talking while you think. So you can only listen to 5 albums for 1 year. What would be those 5 albums? By the way, you don't have to remember the name of the album. Like you said, it could be an album by Los Lobos as an example. So what would be those 5 albums that you would listen to for the rest of the year?
One of them is pretty easy. It'd be Norah Jones. And I listen to her music every day. When I finish my work, I go to the kitchen, whatever I'm doing, cooking. I put on Norah Jones, and she's come up as my top artist for the top 3 years on Spotify. The other one would be more of a genre. I like trio music from Mexico, if you're familiar with that. So I like trio music. So it'd be something around that. What's another album? So that's 2.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to go with, this can make count as 2, but Tupac's first double disc CD, okay. I think, would be my other one. And lastly, I'm just going to go with one of my favorite bands in college, which was Los Lonely Boys. They're from here, from San Angelo.
Yeah.
And so that's one of my other favorite bands.
Cool. What has cannabis meant in your life?
It's meant a change, a new beginning, because it's really what drove me to make changes career-wise. And with that, it's also brought a lot of uncertainty, but it's also brought a lot of growth, because to get into this business has required me to get out of my comfort zone. And so it's cannabis has for me represented a great opportunity and a lot of growth. And I think it's also with some growing pains has meant a lot more freedom in my life.
Okay. Last question. Please describe what your room looked like growing up.
A lot of posters from Target or wherever. Yeah. A Nintendo on my console and a VCR and a little desk with what would be considered now brown, ugly carpet.
It's a great visual. I can see it now. Guillermo, I want to thank you so much. Where can people engage with your services? Where, how can they contact you and social and whatever else you want to share?
Summit Virtual CFO by Anders. Just Google Summit Virtual CFO by Anders. Be a great way to find me. And then I'm on LinkedIn, very active on LinkedIn. My Calendly link is also up to date and on my LinkedIn as well to schedule a call with me. And so pretty easy to find nowadays. You just Google me and I think you'll find me pretty quickly.
Great. Once again, thank you so much for being on. Really appreciate your time. It's great.
Thank you so much, Len. I enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to today's show. To check out more great cannabis podcasts, go to podconnects.com. Here's a preview of one of our other shows.
I'm Joyce Gerber, the creator and host of the award-winning podcast, The Canna Mom Show. And we are on a mission to enhance the impact women have on this industry as business professionals, healthcare providers, policy advocates, caregivers, moms, by sharing and preserving their stories of love and kindness, wisdom, and hope. I am so grateful to have found my tribe of Canna podcasters right here on PodConX. And look forward to our work of crushing the stigma around cannabis and caregivers and building this new industry together.